Thank you all for coming. Nice sunny Friday night. Could be watching a Mariners game, I guess. And they've actually been winning lately, so it's been a nice change of pace. My name is Dwayne Wilkins. I'm the Science Fiction Fantasy Buyer here. I can tell you who's coming up next, but I don't know if all you guys are really hardcore SF fans. You guys want to have a list of who's coming next week? You want to skip that? Well, okay. Jacqueline Carey will be here Monday for Nameless Kiss, her new dark erotic fantasy. And Karen Joy Fowler will be here for the second of the Clarion West readings on Tuesday. They'll both start at 7 o'clock. A lot more going on after that. Tonight, we are welcoming first-time novelist Gregory Wilson, who is a professor of English. And I was thinking of the comparison to Tolkien, that when he's supposed to be writing a serious academic paper, he would say he was writing high fantasy. And hopefully his peers are not sneering at him the same way Tolkien thought he was crazy. But he has come all the way out here to read from the third sign and talk about it. Please welcome Gregory Wilson.
That's good. Okay.
Switch is right.
There. Okay. Thanks very much, Dwayne. First of all, thank you to everybody, many of whom I know, for coming out to this. And I want to thank the University Bookstore, too, as well as Dwayne, for being the first reading on this signing tour. And I'm happy to start it out in Seattle, even though I am myself from the East Coast. So the University Bookstore has proven to be incredibly responsive and supportive, which I appreciate. What I'd like to do is read from this book, The Third Sign. This is the first novel that I've written, and it was published by Five Star Press on June 17th, officially, last week. And I'm going to read a little bit from this and then take maybe a few minutes for questions if people have any. And then after that, I'll be happy to sign stock. And then I'm told we'll need to get the heck out of the store before everything closes down at 8 o'clock. So I'm going to read two sections, if I have time, which I hope I will. The first is the prologue of the book, which introduces some of the problems that this nation is facing. And then second, I'm going to read a little bit from chapter 3, introducing a character called Belezian Drolnar, who is a merchant and a kind of political power broker. Now, I want to quash a very nasty rumor. This person is not directly connected to Jerry Farley, who may or may not be in the audience today. Jerry has believed that this is solely about him. It is not. It is inspired by people with whom he may have occasionally had discourse and conversation, but not him himself. And maybe you'll understand why once you hear more about this guy. So, but first, the prologue. Torek Ilmon, the most recent member of a farmer's bloodline stretching back centuries, perhaps even before the dreamer's first dream, wiped beads of sweat from his brow before bending again to drive his hoe into the earth. It was late summer, and already hints of the oncoming fall were in the air, but hot work was hot regardless of the season. The harvest had been particularly good this year, as good as any that even Torek's grandfather could remember, but that did little to alleviate his workload. Reaping the fruitfulness of the earth had left many wounds, and the soil had to be worked, turned, and coaxed back to its natural aerated condition if it was to yield similar results next spring. This was tiring, tedious work for most, but for Torek it represented a kind of spiritual ritual, a bonding with the land he needed to experience each year to feel he was fulfilling the promise of his heritage. Land was meant to be tilled, dug, shoveled, filtered. It was meant to be used and cared for so that it could be used again, and Torek felt the weight of that responsibility keenly. All the Ilmones did. He was perhaps not the most creative thinker or possessed of the most ambitious, quick mind, but he was committed to his work and difficult to sway from a path he had set for himself. Pulling back on the hoe handle again, Torek stood the implement in the earth as he straightened, sighing with the effort. He looked over his field, almost all resurfaced now from his efforts with the hoe, and beyond that to the borders of the wood that lay to the east of the Ilmon farm. Traxclaw Wood was the official name of the forest, but despite the rumors, it seldom produced anything more dramatic than a wandering bear. Unnatural creatures were few, and unexpected events even fewer. Torek liked it that way, as did his neighbors. Their lives were founded upon regular, predictable cycles, and their existence depended upon careful planning and the application of age-old wisdom. Successions, disasters, and wars certainly happened beyond the borders of his homeland, informally known as the Fields by its residents, but such occurrences made little impact upon its inhabitants. They were content to live as they had for centuries, and it had indeed been centuries since anyone had bothered to interfere with that simple life. Torek grunted with satisfaction as he leaned on his hoe, looking around the borders of his land. Far to the south lay the hills which ran between Tragsclaw Wood to the east and the southernmost area of Razorwood to the west, and even farther to the north were the major cities of the nation of Clun. But Torek, as ever, was most interested in his own space. In his grandfather's time, the field had barely extended to 10 acres, but now it was nearly double that, one of the largest farms in the area and expanding every year. He employed a group of laborers to help him with the upkeep, of course, but they had already been sent home. Torek wanted time to work the land alone, and the unusually good harvest had given him the luxury to indulge himself. This was the time he loved, a few hours of silent thought and careful tending of his ancestral ground. Torek smiled and shook himself out of his late afternoon reverie. He didn't want to waste the remaining light. Bending again to his work, he drove his hoe into the earth. And then, quite suddenly, the air changed. A stillness fell across the land. The wind sank to a sigh, and the atmosphere seemed to close around Torek, who looked up with a frown. The weathermaster in the next village had told him there was not likely to be rain for at least another week, but they were notoriously inaccurate in their predictions, and even when they were right, and the one Torek had consulted was known for his precision, other weathermasters could generate rain at inopportune times when paid enough by jealous rival farmers. Still, such an occurrence had not happened for several years, and he could think of no reason for a weather call to be made now. He sniffed the air and caught a faint, acrid scent, unusual for any normal storm. After a moment, he returned to his work, hoping to at least finish the field he was working on before the rain arrived. But only a few seconds passed before a low moan echoed across the fields. Thank you. Torek looked up sharply. The sound was fairly loud without any prior warning to have heralded it, and seemed relatively close by. Perhaps a bear had stepped on the wrong end of a stick, Torek reasoned. But just as he was about to accept the logical answer and focus his attention back on the earth, the moaning came again, more loudly this time, and closer. It seemed to come from Tragsclaw Wood, and Torek squinted in that direction. He saw nothing but the fences at the end of the land and the trees beyond. But the stillness seemed to grow more oppressive with every passing minute, and there were no clouds visible in the afternoon sky. The moaning sounded again, louder and with a different timbre. Torek thought he heard some kind of a yowling or screeching, like a cat whose late-night caterwauls were silenced by a thrown rock or rival feline. Inadvertently, he shivered. This was no storm, and there was no animal he knew that made such an unearthly sound. Dropping his hoe, he ran to his nearby cart and pulled out a scythe. It was hardly a weapon of war, but its blade was sharp, and he had killed a wolf with it one winter several years ago. But that wolf had been young, and Torek had been knocked up and alone then. He had no idea what he was facing this time. In truth, he had little wish to investigate the noise himself, but he was alone and had no time to run for others. And despite all his imaginings, the sound likely had a simple explanation, as sounds always did. Why give his neighbors the idea that he was imagining things? Gripping the scythe firmly, he ran towards the forest. Torek was no coward, but as he approached the edge of Tragsclaw, his steps slowed. Tragsclaw was not the darkest of woods, nor the densest, but today it felt different, ominous, imposing, heavy. With every step he took, the air seemed to grow closer and more difficult to breathe. After a while, he felt as if he were slogging through mud, so syrupy had the atmosphere become. Pausing at the forest edge, the scythe's handle damp from his sweat, he peered cautiously into the greenery. He saw nothing but the trees standing silent guard on the forest border, scrubs and moss at their feet. But beyond its unnatural stillness, something struck him as wrong about the forest, though he could not put his finger on what it was. His nose and throat stung with the acrid tang in the air.
Will Joshua Duggar please make his access vehicle in front of the store? Thank you.
He was so focused upon the unnatural atmosphere that he had entirely forgotten about what had drawn him to the forest in the first place, the sound. Suddenly the moan echoed again, but this time it seemed to be nearly on top of him, and far louder. And now we clearly heard that it was more than a moan. It sounded like several creatures screaming or yelping at once, but, and this he could not understand, they seemed to be both opposed and combined in some way, like some kind of bizarre chorus of discontent. He froze and looked around slowly. Nothing stirred. And he suddenly realized what had eluded his notice before. He saw no living movement at all. No birds flew, no squirrel stirred, no fox darted from tree to tree. He bent down to the ground and dug experimentally. No insects could be seen in the earth, neither worm nor beetle. The land around him seemed utterly, entirely devoid of life. Torek shook his head and turned away from the woods. Strange as it might seem to his neighbors, something was clearly wrong, and he would rather be labeled a coward than a fool. He headed back to his cart, but he felt as if he were walking through sand. It was now very difficult to breathe fully, and the air felt as if it were trying to crush his body into the earth. His mind swam, and his eyes darted from side to side. He had the odd feeling he was waiting for something. All at once, a great moaning and screeching arose, seemingly all around him, the most terrible noise Torek had ever heard. Screaming and howling came from the forest, but not as isolated noises. Rather, they made up a noise together, one sound of painful torment. As Torek dropped to his knees in terror, he heard for several seconds what he swore were voices, human voices shrieking in the most wrenching agony he could have imagined. He struggled to rise, but all energy and strength had deserted him, and his brain seemed unable to command his legs to move again. His breath came in labored gasps. As he turned his head to look back at the woods, he caught a glimpse of swirling colors and odd shapes, and then, with one more deafening scream of agony, it burst out of the forest and was upon him. The soul wall ravaged north, and there had never been any sound more horrible than that of its passing, now joined by one more unreasoning, hideously distorted shout of agony, as if ripped from the lungs of a still living man. Okay, chapter 3. Drawing his black cloak close against the biting rain, Belezia and Drolnar hurried down the nearly deserted city street and, not for the first time, cursed his bad fortune. It had been bad enough when Duke Galarian had imposed a curfew on an all-too-willing populace, nervous from the increasingly dire news arriving from outside Clunillar, cutting down city traffic and distractions for the night watch as he did so. Now this latest patch of bad weather made it almost inconceivable that anyone would have a good reason to be out this late. But Drolnar did have a good reason, just not one he could share with the typical city guardsman. Far too many questions would result, and he had no time for any of them. The wind whipped the bottom of the cloak around his ankles painfully as he walked, and Drolnar stifled the urge to rip the damned thing off. Without it, he would be soaked to the skin, or at least more soaked than he was at the moment, and would stand out even more than he feared he already did. He knew his way around the streets of Clunillar as well as anyone, and was used to changing routes as necessity demanded. But he was no rogue or assassin, and the merchant garb beneath his cloak was as noticeable as a campfire in the wilderness on a clear evening. As he reached the corner of the main market street, the familiar clank of metal sent him scurrying into a small alcove, his cloak drawn tightly around him. A moment later, two guardsmen appeared, armed with halberds and short swords that hung at their belts, one carrying a hooded lantern that swung back and forth in the wind. As they rounded the corner, the other stopped and put a hand on his companion's shoulder, wiping his face with his other hand. "Why they don't want to issue full gears beyond me," remarked the guard who had first stopped. Wet whiskers plastered on his face made him look vaguely like a waterlogged rat. "Without visors, we can barely see 10 feet in front of us, and I don't know how they expect people to fight when they're drenched." "I've heard the treasury's running low, and they don't have much left to get gear out to those who need it," said his somewhat shorter and clean-shaven companion. "Most of the full gear is out to the Arliks at the border, from what I hear, and the pay, too, I reckon. We'll be the last to get restocked, mark me." The other man snorted. "If they're saving their corn for the Arliks, they're wasting their money," he said, removing one cloth glove and trying vainly to shake some of the moisture out of it. "From what I've heard, they aren't likely to stay at their post much longer, no matter how much gold you throw at them. And there's no way of knowing when they'll decide to give up the whole business and leave." "You better hope you're wrong, Revith," the other said, "or you'll have a lot more than being wet to worry about. What do you think'll happen if they do leave? You've heard the rumors, same as I have, and you know the other side's been building up forces a lot more powerful than the captain's willing to tell us. Who's going to stop them if the Arliks let them through?" "Huh," Revith spat, who, having wrung out one glove, was now squeezing the other. "Whoever will stop them later can't be worse than what we've got now. It's not like the border's been impossible to get over, at least the past 5 years. More than one's gotten through, and a few of them, I hear," he said as he looked at the other man meaningfully, "might be given the orders up top even now." "Shut your mouth," the other whispered urgently, looking around him nervously. "That's traitor talk, and you know it. Besides, you don't have proof. The captain's been at his post the past 10 years. He sounds the same now as he ever did." "Sounds the same, aye," Revith said, undeterred. "But that doesn't mean he is the same. You remember that Marlowe, 3rd Regiment? Friend of mine said he sounded like the same old Marlowe, till one day he murdered half his company in their sleep. And they never found him, neither. He just sort of vanished," my friend said. "Who knows where he got to, or who or what he really was? And even if the captain is just the same, he's got someone he answers to himself. And whoever that is could be giving the orders he wants, if you follow me." "Pah, you're being a fool," the other man scoffed. "The city's got its own people to look after that sort of thing, and it's done it for a long time. So Marlowe lost his grip one night. That don't mean he was one of them. And even if you're right, you want more of them coming through? I don't much see you standing up to a bunch of shapeshifters or worse, any more than I see you getting promoted to captain anytime soon. The Arliks now, they've been willing to do it, and they've beat him before, too. I might be a fool, Solitna, Revif retorted, pulling his glove back on with a frown, but at least I see what's around me. If the Arliks leave their border, and they will leave it, mark me, you'd best be ready to stand and fight if need be, because the enemy will hit Clunillar first. If this city falls, you'll need a lot more than Arliks to stop the storm that blows up next. And if we do have to fight, I'd rather it be with full gear than with this peasant wear. He punctuated this last remark with a hearty shake, like a wet dog trying to dry its fur. Have it your way, Revif, Solitna replied. But as for me, I'm a guardsman, not a border soldier, and I'd rather the Arliks worry about the border than us. In the meantime, we've still got streets to patrol and a report to make, and we're late as is. If there is to be pay, I'd like to be around to get it. Aye, all right, Revif said reluctantly. Not much chance of getting dry, anyway. The pair moved off down the street, still talking, and turned another corner at its end. Drolnar allowed himself a wry smile as he left the alcove and continued the opposite direction. Guardsmen weren't known for their intelligence, but these oafs were a lot closer to the truth than they knew. But only part of the truth. In the end, they had more to worry about than a few shapeshifters and others from the enemy getting through the border. Finding out how much more, in fact, was his purpose this evening. Drolnar quickened his pace as he heard the bell from the town center ring 10 times. He had no wish to be late for his appointment. Those he worked with were not particularly forgiving of lateness, or anything else, from what he could tell, and their meeting was scheduled for 10 minutes past the hour. 2 more streets passed before Drolnar turned right onto a narrow lane. Counting the buildings as he went, he soon began to pass a series of squat, ugly homes. He wrinkled his nose in disgust from the stench, like a combination of rat droppings and blood, he thought with a shudder, and hurried on. He had no idea why the meeting had to take place in this part of the city, an area he came to as little as possible, but he was not in a position to ask questions. Yet, he reminded himself grimly. After another minute, he stopped in front of an unremarkable wooden door on his left and peered down the street in both directions. Other than a rat scurrying behind a barrel, the lane appeared deserted. Satisfied, he leaned over and whispered into the keyhole. A few moments passed, during which time Drolnar wondered a bit nervously if he had miscounted the houses, before the door opened a crack. Dim light streamed out from within. "His coming is known to us," a harsh and guttural voice growled from inside. "Our knowledge is our strength," Drolnar replied promptly. Another moment passed before the door opened wider. "Enter and be quick," said the voice, and Drolnar wasted no time. He was relieved to be out of the rain, and the warmth was welcome, but otherwise this was hardly the most comfortable of meeting rooms. 3 hard wooden chairs waited near the fireplace, all unoccupied, and a cheerless fire flickered in the hearth behind them. Another door was on the far wall, and 1 closed and shuttered window was set in the wall next to the front entrance. A small wooden table sat against the opposite end of the room, upon which a rusty lantern and 3 rough wooden mugs rested. Drolnar started as the door closed behind him with a rather loud bang. "You're late," the voice said as a lock clicked, and he turned to see who was speaking. Drolnar regretted his decision to look almost as soon as he had done so, for the voice was mild compared to the appearance of its owner. He was of medium height and wore a rough woolen cloak unhooded with a scarred and burned leather tunic that had clearly been through more than 1 conflict. A short sword and a pitted leather sheath hung at his side. But far more noticeable was the face, scarred, burned, blue-black in color, with 1 eye socket entirely closed, and not well, by what looked like a simple flap of skin. The other eye, brown and cold, glared at Drolnar with malice and cunning. A huge scar ran from the edge of his mouth to the dirty brown hair that fell about the man's skull like weeds. All in all, Drolnar thought he was looking at quite possibly the most ugly and disturbing face he had ever encountered, and Drolnar's profession ensured he had seen thousands of examples of ugliness in his time. But his profession had also trained him in the art of deception on the highest scale, and he had long ago learned not to betray his feelings openly. So he buried his disgust and looked at him calmly. "I came as quickly as I could," he said, "but this is not the easiest part of the city to find or get to. And I had some work to do to avoid the patrols as well. This would all have been easier if we could have met at the place I suggested first." The other man spat as he walked to the table. "Aye, in the middle of a merchant district, where there are more guards than merchants," he said, taking one of the mugs, "and where you could lay an ambush for me and my lads with your mercenary scum if you wanted more money out of the deal. No, we want no part of your places, cell thief." He chuckled before taking a long drink of whatever the mug held. Drolnar's mouth tightened, and he inadvertently gripped his fist underneath his cloak, as much for the term cell thief as for how close the other man had come to the truth of Drolnar's thoughts. But he quickly regained control and smiled grimly. "You're much too suspicious, friend," he replied. "In the merchant district, my guards are paid by me, not the city. And they get paid enough to keep their mouths shut about whatever they happen to see, or they get their mouths shut for them, permanently. You hardly think," he continued pleasantly, though with the subtlest edge of iron underneath, "that you and your people are the first ones I've dealt with from outside the city. I know more about foreigners than you do, I'll wager, and I understand how to deal with them. If you follow me," he finished with the quiet of a blade being loosened from its sheath. The other man lowered his mug and looked at Drolnar through his one good eye. "And I know how to deal with a fat cutpurse who gets above himself, cell thief." He moved his hand down to the hilt of his short sword almost casually. "We're not friends and won't be. I don't have to buy mine." As Drolnar looked back at the other man's scarred face, he smiled and shrugged off the insult, though inwardly he added the man to his growing list of those he would deal with when he had the chance. "Your own choice. I meant no offense. But we have business to conduct, and the hour is late. I have much to do. We should get started. And I don't deal with shadows," he added as the other man moved his hand away from his sword hilt. "I need a name to you, since you already know mine. It's not hard to know your name, with you shouting it at anyone you think will remember it, Belezian Drolnar," the other man sneered. "And I'm the one calling the shots here, not you. But since you'll hear it anyway soon enough, most people call me Rix. That's good enough for you." He leaned against the wall near the table and took another long drink. "As for getting started, that'll happen when we're all here, and not before." "As you wish," Drolnar replied smoothly, though inwardly his stomach tightened a bit. He had known he would be dealing with more than one person, but he had hoped he would have a single contact within the city. More people meant more variables, and he hated variables that he couldn't influence. Drolnar had built his success on knowledge. Who sold what, who controlled what trade routes, who could be bought, sold, and eliminated. The city should have moved against a circle of contacts years ago, and would have if Drolnar were not aware of nearly every tryst, double deal, and sordid activity of the city's officials. The Duke himself had more than one skeleton in his closet, though Drolnar had to be careful not to overuse that knowledge. Ilarion was concerned about his public image, but more concerned with his own power, and he had his own network of spies and informants, only a couple of whom were actually on Drolnar's payroll. It was a dangerous game, but one with rich rewards, and Drolnar had played it to perfection for almost 10 years. During that time, more than one pretender aspiring to political and economic power had appeared on the scene, but almost always proved to be nothing more than a puppet backed by a local guildhouse, or sometimes just a fresh-faced young merchant with delusions of grandeur, and both kinds were easily dealt with. The last such pretender had done fairly well for himself, actually, until he went too far by wanting to put Drolnar's network out of business. He was soon found in the Sorth Quarter in an alley behind a local inn, his throat horribly torn out and his mouth full of coins. Things had quieted down considerably since then. Still, Drolnar could never afford to be overconfident. His power was based entirely on who and what he knew and when he knew it. When he had gotten wind of a new power rising in the city, he had been inclined to dismiss it as a series of drunken hallucinations. Even he couldn't afford to track down every dead-end story. But the rumors persisted, and other signs began to appear. The disappearance of usually reliable contacts, reduction of normal commerce, protracted silences from the city's other merchant leaders. And of course, there was the political situation outside the city, the problem with the Arleks, and the threat of war. A general climate of unease had descended upon Clunillar, and that was bad for both business and political maneuvering. So Drolnar had taken it upon himself to track down the meaning behind the disturbances and determine both what threat it posed and how he could turn that threat to his advantage. Weeks had passed before he had turned up any leads at all beyond the usual rumors and vague mutterings of a few tavern locals. He had begun to despair of discovering anything significant about the matter until it had, so to speak, sought him out. 5 days ago, on the evening Drolnar was supposed to have met one of his most reliable contacts in one of his counting houses, the merchant was startled out of his musings on the problem by a cry in the street outside, suddenly cut short. By the time Drolnar had reached the door, his two guards, both city guardsmen by profession, although in fact on his payroll, had arrived from their posts and were crouched over a body on the street, an arrow protruding from its back. As Drolnar ordered the two to circle the perimeter of the house looking for the assailant, he himself was always protected by more than just guardsmen, he noticed a small note attached to the arrow, which was in the fresh corpse of his unfortunate informant, and unfolded it. "Call off your dogs, merchant, or we'll bring them to heel ourselves," the note began. "If you want to know who we are and why we're here, be at the meeting in 5 days. If not, stay clear, or the next arrow lodges in your heart." Crude directions followed, along with a password for entry. Drolnar had not reacted visibly, but his mind raced with a mixture of admiration for the group's work and anger at the position in which he found himself, uncertain for the first time in an age as to what to do next. Certainly he could not ignore the threat. There were few in the city who could attack his operatives with impunity, and he was sure anonymity. He doubted his guards would find any sign of the attacker. The message had been sent by a professional, and professionals covered their tracks. The loss of the informant was inconvenient, to be sure. Creating reliable and loyal contacts was not an easy thing. But contacts were replaceable in time. And Drolnar had been threatened more times than he could remember by groups considerably more dangerous than an assassin in the shadows. He was not concerned about his own safety. What was most troubling was that he had somehow been connected directly to the search, unusual given the care with which he conducted his investigations. And that meant that for the first time, someone had as much or more information than he did. After hearing the reports of his unsuccessful guards and ordering them to dispose of the body quietly, Drolnar resolved to close the information gap quickly. And here he was, 5 days later, with little more information now than when he had started. Still, he had a name, Rix, and a face to put it with, and that was itself an advantage. Patience, he reminded himself, would reveal the rest. A whispered hiss suddenly emanated from the front door's keyhole, and the man who called himself Rix pushed himself away from the wall and silently set his mug on the table. Drawing his sword, he moved quietly over to the door, and after a short pause, cracked it open, peering through the narrow slit. "His coming is known to us," he whispered. A deep and rattling voice replied, "Our knowledge is our strength." Rix sheathed his sword and opened the door wide as it could go, in fact, for the creature that entered needed every inch to squeeze through. Drolnar's eyes widened as the huge being, at least 8 feet tall and as solid as an ox, made its way through the opening into the house. It was covered in a sopping wet black cloak like Drolnar's, the size of 3 of them, in fact, though as the creature removed the garment, the merchant thought he caught a glimpse of an odd symbol inscribed on the cloak's lining. But he barely had time to process the thought, as it was all he could do to keep his mouth from dropping open at what had worn the cloak. The creature was covered in short brown hair that bristled as he brushed the raindrops off, and his lower legs, impossibly rippled with muscles, ended in cloven shoes, iron-shod, and with one wicked iron spike at each shoe's tip. The upper legs and torso were covered in a kind of sturdy, dark brown hide armor carved with a host of strange symbols and runes. The arms were bare and covered in the same coarse brown hair, muscles like iron knitted and relaxed as the creature cleaned itself of the rest of the moisture. But what most amazed Drolnar was the creature's head, massive, covered in hair, and with a protruding bull-like snout. Saber-like teeth extended outside the mouth and onto the sides of the lower jaw, and 2 short but sharp horns emerged from the powerful skull, which ducked low to avoid hitting the ceiling. The eyes, yellow with black pupils, glared out from beneath 2 bristling eyebrows, and Drolnar had the uneasy sense of being examined both inside and out. He had never seen one of these creatures, but he had heard them described many times, sometimes with respect, often with fear, occasionally with admiration. But no description did justice to the truth. Drolnar was unquestionably staring at an Arlek. Rix closed the door and slid the bolt closed before turning back to the new arrival. "You're late, Sikar," he muttered, "and you know the schedule's tight." The creature turned its baleful eyes back to the one-eyed man and stared at him for a moment. Had even Rix quailed slightly in the face of that gaze, Drolnar wondered, and then snorted, its nostrils flaring slightly. "I come at my own time, Rix," Sikar replied in a deep bass voice that rattled as it exhaled, "and only the destroyer wills when that will be. I had to avoid the guards. The city must have doubled the watch in the past month, and not many work for us yet. And time is with us and against our enemies. None can stop the return." "Whether or not they can," Rix replied, "they can make things difficult for us to speed its coming. And my lads won't be patient for long. I can only beat sense into so many of them, and the rest are hungry for the pay they've been promised. Some of them are wondering when this will all happen." Again the Arlek paused before answering, breathing deeply. "None can stop the return," he repeated. Then, as if struck by a thought, he turned his head a little to the side and opened his eyes wider. "Unless you doubt it will occur?" he inquired, his voice rising slightly with the question as his muscled arms tightened nearly imperceptibly. Drolnar was no warrior, but no one read body language better than he, and a barely concealed threat lay below the surface of the question. Rix did not miss the point, and chuckled slightly.
though in a somewhat forced way. "Oh, I have faith in the return and the reward promised, but my lads have seen nothing of either so far, and they're getting restless. We need to move soon." Sikarb moved his head upright again. "We will act as the destroyer wills. Our moment will come in due course." He paused, then turned his head back towards Drolnar, his eyes widening and nostrils flaring slightly as he observed the merchant. For his part, Drolnar hoped his evident shock at seeing the Arlek had subsided enough to prevent comment, because it was quite evident to him that despite Rix's earlier claim, the one-eyed man was not in fact calling the shots in this affair, any more than Drolnar could have survived more than a few seconds in a fight with the beast who regarded him now with obvious contempt. Sikarb clearly did not particularly care about Rix one way or the other, and Drolnar hoped to use that information to his advantage when he could. "Who is this?" Sikarb said at last, a low growl in his throat. "Belezian Drolnar, merchant at your service," he replied, bowing low. "I was told I might be interested in your proceedings here tonight, and..." "I was not informed of others being involved," Sikarb said, turning to Rix as the merchant, very unused to being both interrupted and ignored, all within the space of a sentence, sputtered as he tried to regain his composure. "You were warned about the need for care." "This merchant," spat Rix, "has more or less run a good part of this city for nigh on 10 years, and he started asking around about us. Of course, we could have just killed him, but there was no need for unnecessary questions, and his influence could prove useful. He was told either to back all the way off or get all the way in, and you can see for yourself what he chose." "I see," said Sikarb, turning his massive head again back to Drolnar, who had now regained his placid demeanor. "Then you know why we are here, and what we intend to do. And you know what steps must be taken to make it happen." Drolnar hesitated for a split second under the Arlek's withering gaze. It was dangerous to admit ignorance, but to lie and to be wrong could have even more dangerous consequences. Rix, however, saved him from having to make the perilous choice by answering for him. "He knows almost nothing, Sikarb, nothing more than any fool could discover by keeping his eyes and ears open. All of Clun Ilar knows something's up, something serious, but not many know what to do about it except cower in their beds and hope someone else fixes things for them. As for this one, he..." Now it was Drolnar's turn to cut the other off, which he did with gusto, ignoring the other's murderous glare as he spoke. "I'm no ordinary citizen cowering in a bed, friend," said Drolnar, "and I know more than you think. I've been more closely connected to this city and its workings than the Duke himself for years now, and I know when things are..." He chose his words carefully. "Unusual. It's bad for business when they are, and I know nothing about it, and it's my business to ensure I do know. Specifics and details, well," he chuckled, "that's what I'm here to discover. But the basics? I know those as clearly as I knew the password to get in this room. You risk no lost confidences by speaking in front of me." The last two statements were absolute and utter lies, but despite what Drolnar did not know, he certainly knew a foreigner when he saw one. And it was evident to him that both of the other two he faced, especially Sikarb, had little knowledge of city politics or networks. This was a gamble, but a reasoned one, and Drolnar seldom played a hunch wrong. Rix spat loudly. "This cell thief is a liar, Sikarb, and he knows little more about this than the informant of his we skewered last week. I..." Sikarb raised one massive arm, silencing Rix, and stared at the merchant for what seemed an eternity. "Perhaps not," Sikarb finally said. "But we act as the destroyer wills, and it is not clear to me what role this merchant must play. Certainly he is lying about some things, but he is telling the truth about others, and if he learned enough about you that he became a threat, there may be others who followed a similar path." He moved closer to Drolnar, towering over him despite having to crouch below the low ceiling, and glared down at him, hot breath flowing from his nostrils. "If what you know of Clun Ilar is of use to us, you will be allowed to live upon the destroyer's return. Indeed, you may even become a part of it. If it is not," the beast continued in an almost gentle rumble, lowering his great head to just above the merchant, who was paralyzed by a mixture of fear and fascination with the Arlek's great yellow eyes, "you will die with all the others, your own heart's blood drowning your cries for mercy. None can stop the return, and none will." An hour later, a shaken Belezian Drolnar emerged from the small house and hurried down the street the way he had come, trying to avoid splashing in the puddles left from the now-ended rainstorm. But even his anxious glances darted from side to side could not catch the shadow of a creature that silently slipped out from behind a barrel to follow him, a shadow which, had he been looking at it directly, he would have sworn had changed from that of a rat to that of a hooded man. Merchant and shadow both made their way down the deserted streets of the city. I think I'll stop there. So I think we have about 5 minutes or so for...
The store will close at 8, so you can either buy a book, you can either buy then. So I figure it would be about 10 minutes or so for questions.
Sure. That's great. So if you have any questions about publication or the book or what comes next within reason. Yes, please.
Do you expect this to be a series that you're going to create over time?
I hope so. It's part of a planned trilogy. The publisher of this book, unfortunately, is probably going to be getting out of fantasy after this year. And so I'm going to be going to another publisher, at least that's the theory. If it sells well, I'll be going to another publisher. But yes, it is part of a planned trilogy. There are some loose ends tied up at the end of this book, but not too many. So there's more to come afterwards. Yes.
When you say loose ends, do you mean that you kind of left something unstated so you'll, that the reader will be interested in going to the next?
Yeah, I would say so. I don't leave it a total cliffhanger. They sort of drop down a level on the cliff, you know? So they know a little bit about what happens, but not all of it. Yeah. Sure. Sir, please.
I really don't see the too many differences between that guy and the person you were mentioning.
I don't know if I should just make a comment or just let it go.
The sputtering bit
wouldn't have happened. Okay. Otherwise, though, it's accurate. Okay.
Pretty close.
I don't know if someone you knew would ever have met someone like an Arlick, but not quite that.
I've met a few Arlicks.
Okay. I hope it ended better than it did for this guy. We'll see.
I don't know how things are going out yet, but...
Yeah, but we'll see.
Do you have any sense of what you would consider success in terms of sales?
Well, Five Star is a smaller publisher, which on the one hand is a it's a drawback in that it means that distribution is not as good as it would be for a huge publisher like Tor or Daw or Del Rey or something like that. The benefit of it is, though, that it's a smaller print run, and so if I sell, you know, a more limited number, and I don't want to get into, you know, exact numbers, but if I sell a more limited number, that will look good to the larger houses that would pick up work coming from this point forward. And in fact, I'm going to be co-editing an anthology of speculative fiction and politics, which is a collection of short stories with a lot of Hugo and Nebula award-winning authors, which I found sort of through contacts that I made through this book. And hopefully between that and hopefully the success of this book, the second novel and, you know, future novels will get picked up. I have two other series as well that are unrelated to this, one of which is finished and is being submitted, and another one which I'm working on now. So I hope that with all of these balls in the air that, you know, one of them is going to come through eventually, if I can mix metaphors, but anyway. So that's the theory. Yes, please.
I don't have a question, but I have a statement.
Okay.
You write beautifully, you read beautifully. I wish you all the success, and I want to have time to buy a book, so do I...
Well, actually, we're going to have some books here, and I'll be able to sign them so afterwards. But thank you. I appreciate that. Thank you.
I like the way you a sentence, you lead in with a clause or a phrase at the beginning of it, and then the import comes later. So it does require more diligent reading than a lot of novels that you would buy.
I hope. Thank you. I hope that is a positive for people, and they don't go, I want an easy read. I hope so. But I started as an academic writer, and so, you know, I'm a professor and I write academic work, and I kind of came from that. Although I'm drawn really increasingly to this kind of stuff. So it's a good thing I have tenure, because now my school can't. You know, you're publishing another one of those. So, Shar, you were going to ask.
I was going to ask about your writing process. Sit down every day and write, or do you have inspiration?
At least 3 hours a day. No, I wish. My 17-month-old keeps me running around a little bit for that. I have gone back and forth. What I try to do is set myself longer-term goals, where I'll say, by the end of the summer, I want, you know, X number of chapters completed, or by the end of the year, I want X, you know, X amount of sections finished. And I found that it got much easier for me to write this having written other things. You know, once I had written that book that I have over on the table, which was basically a revision of my dissertation, it became a lot easier, because then I was like, okay, I can actually sit down and write. Before that, I was the champion of great beginnings. I have, you know, 50 tremendous beginnings that are just great, and they go for about 2 pages and then they stop because I got bored. And you know. So this was the first time that I actually was able to sit down and complete it, and it helped to have done other things where I was forced to, because people said, well, we just can't write 2 pages of a dissertation, Greg. So so I had to write that, and that sort of taught me how to read this. So it's a matter of sort of persistence, and setting smaller goals is important, because this is 114,000 words, which, by, as Duane will know, by fantasy standards actually is somewhat smaller. A lot of the norm in fantasy is like 130,000, 140,000, 150,000 words, which is a lot, and I don't know that you always need those extra 40,000 plus words always, but in any case, it takes sort of diligence to continue doing it. So I try to set myself sort of longer term goals, which has worked pretty well so far. My second novel is already finished. I'm working on the third, so I hope, you know, that's doing a job. No, I do have a few chapters of the sequel written for this too, but no, it's of an unrelated series. The book is called Icarus. That's the one that I'm hoping to go to another publisher with, and then hopefully they'll pick up everything, including the sequel to this book. So.
This is the one that has...
This is the one that has Senevine, yes. Let them make an announcement first.
And the store will now close in 15 minutes at 8 o'clock.
Okay. So, my daughter's name is Senevine, and it was my wife Clea's idea. It was not my idea. We were thinking of names, and we got one of those 50,000, you know, name books, and we went through them all, and she had liked the name Senevine, and I said, well, I don't know, that's kind of, it'll be a little awkward when she gets old enough to know what it means. And she said, well, you know, I like the name. And so she is named Senevine. But, you know, in the book, she's a princess. So, you know, it won't be that bad. And she, when I originally wrote the character, I was thinking about Clea. So, interestingly, Clea is sort of tied together with my daughter now, which was a nice sort of side effect of all that.
Time, so. Sure. Dream parts of your book?
Do I dream parts of my book? Not directly. Yeah, not directly, but I daydream it. Maybe that's a better way to put it. The soul wall idea, which is that prologue that I read you, came to me, I don't even remember exactly where, but I remember thinking about this idea of this moving, shapeless, and in the book you find out much more about what that thing is, of course, that sort of was inscrutable and nauseating and bizarre and sort of omnipresent. You know, you couldn't get away from it. When you see it, you know, that Toric, that's the last thing Toric ever knows about is that wall. And I had gotten that idea, I don't even remember exactly where, but I remember very vividly imagining the shape of what the soul wall would be and what it would look like and sound like. And actually, I have a guy who designed part of this into a popular video game. Which is available. So he did a very good job of sort of representing that in the video game, which was kind of cool. You know, someday maybe I'll get the big blockbuster movie, but it is pretty neat just to even see a video game of someone imagining visually the world that you interpreted imaginatively. So, yeah.
So. What's the name?
One more question.
Well, let's take one more question and then get to the science.
Okay.
What's the game?
Oh, it's Neverwinter Nights 2. The module for Neverwinter Nights 2 called The Third Sign. And it's about 2 hours. It's a trailer, but it was done by a professional game designer who works for Ossian Studios and BioWare, and is also a sophomore at Harvard. So he's a typical genius. I happen to run into the Wunderkind. So I said, all right, well, you're my guy. And so it was a lot of fun going through that. Yeah. So... All right, so I guess I'm going to be there and doing those things. All right, so thank you very much. I'll be here to sign.